You are listening to the Indefensive Plants podcast, a show designed to cure plant blindness around the globe. Support for Indefensive Plants comes from listener donations. If you would like to give your support to Indefensive Plants, please consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants. And together, we can help cure plant blindness one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefensiveplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How's everyone doing this week? I've got an exciting citizen science opportunity for you today, especially if you're interested in getting to know mosses a little bit better. Joining us from Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, is Dr. Rafa Medina, and he is focusing on mechanisms of evolution and speciation among plants, but specifically mosses. And this involves, to some extent, genome duplication, so we're talking polyploidy today, but he needs your help. He's using a moss species called the common bladder moss, Psychometrium pyriformi, to understand how polyploidy, among other things, can lead to speciation events. Now, the great thing about this moss is it's probably in your backyard right now. As far as I have come to understand, it's present on every continent except Antarctica and South America. I'm going to let Dr. Medina talk about this to you in much more detail. I don't want to steal any of his thunder, but just again, pay attention to what he's asking, because after the show, you can go to indefensiveplants.com/podcast. Check out the link for this episode and get all of the citizen science stuff you need, all the information. You're going to get a packet, you're going to get all this information on how to identify and collect samples even, and you can even have your own samples be raised in a lab and used directly for his work. It's pretty exciting stuff. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Medina. I hope you enjoy. Well, Dr. Rafael Medina, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How about you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Thank you, Matt. Well, first thing, I have learned so much about the plants of the Midwest thanks to your videos. Really happy of being here today. Thank you.
Great. Well, welcome.
As you said, my name is Rafael Medina. I am assistant professor of the Department of Biology of Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. During all my scientific career, the focus of my interest have been mosses, so that little group of bryophytes. You know, originally I was interested in taxonomy and phylogeny, and then, you know, with years I have also joined the wave of high-throughput sequencing, and that's more or less where I am now.
Very exciting. So was it always about plants, or did you kind of come to plants later as just a convenient way to test a lot of the hypotheses in taxonomy and systematics?
Pretty much all the time I have felt I'm a botanist and a bryologist in particular. Mm.
And where did this obsession with mosses come from? Because oftentimes people get into plants, they like flowers or trees, big things, and mosses tend to be smaller and a little more esoteric for some, although once you get into them, they're fascinating. What attracted you to mosses in the first place?
Well, I admit that that was also my case, you know, when it's a shame actually, but at this point of my career, but originally I thought, okay, I'm interested in plants and I'm interested in any type of plants, but you know, real plants, not these mosses that they are so, you know, obscure. But then when I was an undergrad student, my mentor back in Madrid, Spain, he offered me the chance to do like a very basic floristic thing. And when I started looking at mosses through the dissecting scope, well, then everything changed at that point.
That's a beautiful introduction, because really appreciating mosses does include some sort of magnification. But as soon as you unlock that view on the bryophyte world, it really is just, it's an eye-opening experience, to sound cliche, but mosses are incredible plants, are they not?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. You know, the first time, and I can see this in my students, the first time you take that step of using a microscope and just look at them through those lenses, it's like what is like a green patch, it becomes like a rainforest. And I really appreciate that that moment of changing the perspective.
Yeah, and that's a really neat position to be in as a professor dealing with students, is so many of them probably come in ignorant to the world of botany, let alone these plants, but then to give them that power of doing it themselves and seeing that in person, it must really turn the lights on, at least to get these kids looking a little bit closer at, you know, that fuzzy patch on a tree or a fuzzy patch of moss growing on the cracks of a sidewalk.
Yeah, I can see in them the same situation that I experienced myself. So at first, they are probably not super excited about that, but I know that they just need a chance and they will understand why they are so cool, actually.
Indeed. Now, this may seem like an obvious question to you, of course, and to many of the listeners, but I guess just superficially, for those listening that aren't familiar with what really makes mosses mosses, what distinguishes them from the rest of plants, say ferns or angiosperms or conifers? What makes mosses distinct? Mm.
Well, first of all, I said before that they were as small plants, but this is mostly about the size, right? Mm. In terms of diversity, they are actually the second most diverse lineage of plants after angiosperms, after flowering plants.
Wow.
Yeah, so there are a lot of mosses out there.
Huh.
And they belong to a group of plants that, I mean, they are, as a group, recognized as bryophytes. And, I mean, all plants have, like, two generations. This is a little bit, you know, difficult to see when we are seeing flowering plants. But all plants do, right?
Sure.
But in the case of mosses, the generation that we usually see, the dominant generation, the leafy part, the green part, is indeed the gametophyte. So a generation with only, let's say, N number of chromosomes. And usually you don't see these in flowering plants. This generation is obscure or is very small, right? Mm. But in bryophytes, what you see is actually haploid. It has half number of chromosomes that you would expect.
Huh.
And then when sexual reproduction happens, you see the other generation. If you pay attention to, you know, your backyard or you are lucky and you see like a fertile colony of mosses, very frequently you see like small capsules that are like elevated through a stalk and spores are produced there. Well, that's actually like the daughter plant of the colony. It's the sporophyte. And the anatomy of that sporophyte is, if I had to say it like very fast, it's what defines this particular group of plants. It's very, very unique and different to other bryophytes and the rest of the plants.
Yeah, and that is one of the more easily recognizable parts of a moss, if, again, provided people are getting down and looking close enough. But it's so fascinating to think. I had no idea that there's such diversity. And I hate when people call mosses primitive or basal. They're really not. You're seeing an evolutionary success story to almost like the greatest degree you could possibly think of in terrestrial biology, right? These are winning evolutionary designs that have obviously succeeded on a global scale.
Yeah, absolutely. It's to me, it's as if they chose like a different path for success that is perhaps like not showy, not based on growing too big or becoming very complex. But they are amazing if you think about all the things that they can do, like surviving without water for long periods of time. Many mosses can do that.
Mm.
Don't ask a giant sequoia to do something like that. Impossible, right?
Sure, yeah. And the test of time. I mean, I've seen moss colonies on sun-baked granitic rocks at the top of mountains. I mean, just dealing with life like no other organisms really can. And they seem just at home and happy.
Yeah, something I say sometimes to my students is when they judge in terms of complexity or size is, what is better, a desktop computer or a smartphone? And there is no clear answer for that, right? Because every device has a different niche. So that's a way to think about this. Not necessarily because you are bigger or you are more complex. You are like, as you said before, like more evolved, or I don't know the word you use, but you know, you get the idea.
Right. That's a really good analogy. I actually really appreciate that connection to be made, because the people can kind of grasp that a lot better than they can, you know, this perceived hierarchy that most people have that is wrong in evolution.
Yeah, exactly.
So you are, as you mentioned, into taxonomy and systematics, and it's amazing that you've obviously picked the realm of life that is second only to angiosperms in diversity, but I know this is a slippery slope for any biologist to be asked, but is there a good species concept in mosses, or does it vary depending on the groups, the families? How easy is it to delineate species in moss?
Well, you know, I actually love that question.
Good.
Because species concepts and species delimitation, I mean, I think it's something very interesting. And of course, we are not necessarily going to agree in all the details, but I would say it's not very different to the same type of problems that we have found in other plants or other organisms. So traditionally, everything depended on morphological species concept. Mm-hmm. That, of course, for bryophytes or for mosses, it's tricky because they are very small. Mm-hmm. And the key characters to identify species, well, sometimes they are tiny. And some people consider that they were like not relevant enough. A lot of discussions may have arisen by, you know, whether a particular structure was 2 cells wide or 4 cells wide. I don't know.
Wow.
Just to give you an example, right? The characters are going to be tiny. But of course, bryology also benefited from the explosion of molecular phylogenetics. I mean, an event that it's still ongoing, but I think we can all agree now that it's helping to clarify a little bit how many taxonomic units should we recognize, or at least to understand better what is the evolutionary history beyond, you know, all these names.
Right. And so, whereas before, like you said, you had to get a sample back to the lab, you had to have high-powered magnification, and you really had to know in detail what it was you were looking for, I'm guessing now what you can do is get a sample, extract genetic material, and get a better idea, at least, of is this population related, or are these two different species, or, you know, what is the structure of this group, so to speak, in a given area?
Yes, I mean, from my point of view, you still have to do both things, right?
Okay.
I think that cryptic species are particularly abundant within bryophytes because they are so tiny that sometimes the phylogenetic or the evolutionary history doesn't leave a signature in the morphology that you can see easily. Hmm. But it's also true that once we have molecular phylogenetics, many of the species that were described in the 19th century based on, you know, tiny differences that some people thought they were irrelevant, turned out to be correct.
Huh, wow.
So, yeah, this is a little bit my personal opinion, but I believe that taxonomy should be integrative and that, you know, you should consider all the different points of view. And I actually would add a third point of view now, which is polyploidy or ploidy level, which is actually my most recent interest.
Yeah. And that's intriguing to think about, you know, this idea of cryptic species. You see it sometimes in birds, you see it in lizards, and you see it a lot of times in plants. Now, to those that aren't familiar with what that means, you kind of hinted at it. This could be that you thought one population of moss was made up of one species, but then, you know, morphologically, okay, that kind of gets confirmed. But then you look deeper, you see that genetically they're split up. That happens, I would assume, quite a bit in some of these smaller, nondescript organisms.
Yeah, absolutely. And an additional layer of complexity is, you know, mosses disperse via spores, mm-hmm. which they have the potential to travel long distances. You still may have endemics, but you also have species that are distributed along a very wide area. So it can get really messy and complicated.
Yeah, I sometimes feel a little bit of envy from my fungal colleagues in the same way, is that you get a bunch of spores up into the jet stream and then there's really no limit to where they could end up on the globe. And that's pretty remarkable when you think about how truly small some of these are. But again, size is often in their favor when you want, a global distribution.
Yeah.
So you mentioned polyploidy. And before we really dive into, you know, why you're on here and the project you have coming up, I think it would be good to talk about polyploidy from just a genetic standpoint and what that means for an organism. You know, I was taught that for most animals, you have the haploid sex cells. They form to make a diploid organism that divides. And anytime you get duplication in a genome, it's largely detrimental. But for plants, that does not seem to hold true whatsoever. Can you explain a bit about polyploidy and what that means?
Well, it means exactly what you said. If you are expected to have a particular number of chromosomes, if you double or amplify that number, then you may have like a polyploid there. But I really like that you started talking about animals because it's totally true, right? Mm-hmm. We don't expect animals to have severe changes in their chromosome numbers because that would probably be lethal. But in plants, they have their own rules. We know that. So. Yeah, so having these polyploids, so you have like a species or a population and it has like 20 chromosomes in every cell. Let's think about that. having other populations with 40, with 60, with 80, well, it seems that it's not that uncommon, and actually that might be a fundamental way in which plants evolve and diversify. And so that's already like something interesting.
Yeah.
There are different types of polyploidy, and one the type that seems to be more obscure or more difficult to detect, it's autopolyploidy, which is basically a whole genome duplication. Just you start with a particular genome, a particular set of chromosomes, and then the daughter lineage or the next generation will have exactly double that number.
And what's causing this? Is there a known factor? Are there many factors? Is it an accident? Is this something that, you know, say a genome can coordinate itself? It just seems outlandish that you can get so many copies.
There are several types of mechanisms that may trigger polyploidy and autopolyploidy. For example, if you think if something goes wrong during meiosis and you have gametes that are not reduced, that they keep like the original chromosome number, that may be a way in which this may happen, for example. Okay. But this is already like a, you know, like a field in expansion, because many of these polyploids, they are very difficult to detect. The genes are going to be the same. So if you try to run like a, you know, phylogenetic analysis, chances are that you will not find any new genetic signature, and the morphology, it may be very similar or the same. So we might be surrounded by polyploid plants and we don't know it.
Is that because when you run the DNA, you just, it would just come up like you just have a lot of it without a mutation in different chromosomes? You wouldn't really know that the amount you're getting is because there's more copies or just because you got a good sample?
Well, what I mean is, nowadays, when you use DNA as, let's say, as a barcode to identify what taxon you are dealing with, it's all about a particular sequence that you use, right? If you double that sequence, well, you have more DNA, but the sequence is still the same. Mm. So maybe that polyploid is virtually transparent and we are not detecting it. And as I said, this is something that we are realizing now, that it might have a more specific weight than we thought.
Huh. And that's super exciting, again, especially because in plants, it doesn't seem to be a detrimental mutation to have. Whereas in humans, you know, you'd be lucky if the embryo ever came to term. What do you think really is different about plants and their makeup that makes polyploidy not so lethal to the organism? Or can you even speculate at this point?
Well, to be honest, I have no idea.
Perfect.
Yeah. No, this seems to be something intrinsical to plants, right? It's probably not fair to say that it's never detrimental. They might experience negative consequences. But it's obvious that, let's say, it's a mechanism that it belongs to their own evolutionary mechanism or their own way to evolve. But I don't know why.
Sure. And that's what's great about science is we're 2018, we think we've figured it all out, but there's still just so much we don't know and so many questions to ask.
Yeah, definitely a lot of questions. And this is a field full of questions that need to be answered.
Sure. And now, in terms of speciation, this is kind of your forte here. As soon as you get a polyploid event, is that a new species or do things have to change? Sorry, we're just trying to like narrow down before we really dump into the meat of it. But is that kind of the concept, or when does polyploidy eventually lead to a speciation event?
Well, we will find here again this conversation about what is the species concept, right? But I'm not going to go there yet, but let's just say that reproductive isolation is going to be at least relevant, right? You may think that that's the only species concept that is valid, the biological species concept, and we can agree or not, but at least we can say that reproductive isolation has something to say about what constitutes a species and what doesn't. And now it's when it gets interesting. If you double your chromosome number, technically that's going to be a problem. You will not be able to interbreed again with the lineage that was there before the polyploid event, right? Because your chromosome number are not going to match.
I see.
But we can even go beyond that. If you have two independent polyploidization events, well, technically the two new autopolyploids should be able to interbreed, but it turns out that we really don't know what's going on, because the genome is not stable once you have suffered this autopolyploidy. And chances are, We know this because of some experiments and some papers that have been published during the last 20 years, that sometimes the changes occur so rapidly after the polyploidization event that you may even become isolated from other equivalent polyploid lines.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, a lot of questions there.
Yeah, and this is a really exciting realm to be getting involved with, especially as it relates to, like you said, these speciation events that can happen almost, you know, overnight, so to speak. So what are some of the benefits? Like, when a genome gets duplicated, is that just more copies to work with? You can have mutations in one while still preserving function in others. I mean, is it generally associated with different kinds of character traits in mosses? Or is it just extremely hard to detect no matter what you do?
I think you nailed it. You said two things that are very relevant for this. First, when you have several copies of your old genes, then you have your hands free to actually open the possibility for a few of them to acquire new functions while you still retain the old functions of the original genes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have some opportunities there for, let's say, evolving into something new on the long term. At the same time, having a different genetic load, you know, it may change the quantity of the proteins that you are producing, and that may also affect your ecological niche. So maybe the polyploid will actually have slightly different requirements than the original haploid plant.
Wow. That's pretty remarkable to consider. I mean, you would think a polyploidy event and then potentially there's more drought resistance. Suddenly this moss can live in a place its cousin couldn't.
Yeah, and it will take a lot to actually answer those questions. We are not even there yet. And we should not rule out that some of the effects are indeed detrimental. That's also right. Part of the, yes.
Right. So, okay, the main reason we got in touch is because you have just acquired some funding for a big project that involves all of the things we've been talking about. So how about we start at the beginning of that? You have chosen to work with a moss,
mm-hmm.
and investigate some of this polyploidy. So I guess to start, what is the moss and what motivated this project to start with?
Yes, that's right. So the system that we will be using for this project, its name is Physcomitrium piriforme, also known as the goblet moss.
I like that.
Yeah, I like that name too. There are others, but I think this is best.
Yeah.
It deserves to have a common name because it's actually a very common moss. I mean, there's nothing extraordinary about where it grows. It's growing in our backyards, in flat plains, all over North America and Eurasia.
Hmm.
And it turns out it's not that difficult to identify. Actually, from some interactions that I have had with some people and amateurs, it's a moss that people recognize relatively easily.
Right. So this is something that anyone listening in, say, the Northern Hemisphere, for the most part, can go outside and probably find in their own backyard, like you said.
Mm-hmm. It's easy to find. Yes,
so for just a casual listener that doesn't have Google right now, what does this little moss look like? Very moss-like, I'm assuming?
Well, unlike many other mosses that are perennials, that, you know, they just live like all year round. You go, no matter what month of the year you go, you will always see it there. This is an ephemeral moss, okay? So that's also to take into account. They have a life cycle that has to be completed in just a few weeks because they live in areas that are like, as I said, floodplains or moist parts of a prairie or lawns next to parks and everything. But whenever the conditions are more or less moist, they have a leafy part that is very, very short and very small, not very eye-catching.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what makes it distinctive is the sporophyte, this capsule that we were mentioning before, right? That generation.
Right.
They are tiny, they are very small, but especially when they are mature, they acquire a shape that reminds of a goblet, so that's why they receive this name. I mean, you still have to pay attention. It's not a very big moss, but I think it's an interesting challenge for people to try to find it.
Yeah, and like you said, if it's sitting in our backyards, it's a relatively easy challenge to kind of undertake for your novice bryophyters.
Yes, we have prepared a training pack also. So I hope I will talk in a second about the citizen science project. We will be asking for people to help us learn more about this moss. So there you will have all the information about how to find it and how to recognize it.
Very cool. So you have this moss that's kind of got this ephemeral, almost annual life cycle. It's well adapted to disturbance in the wild, which means it's probably hanging around human settlements quite a bit. Is that kind of the reason why understanding and using this moss is convenient for the work you're trying to do?
Well, let's say that that's just a fortunate circumstance.
Okay.
So it's good that it's easy to find and that it's everywhere and it's easy to, you know, to collect. But the main reason is that there's a lot going on there. I mean, we name it Physcometrium piriforme, but from the taxonomic point of view, it's really messy. There are, just to give you an idea, okay, there are 29 synonyms.
Whoa.
And in the bibliography, there have been several cytological studies, and apparently there are up to 7 different karyotypes.
Dang.
So there you go, right? You have a moss that is very common, it's everywhere. It looks like one species from the morphological point of view, but it's not. I mean, we are pretty sure at this point that it's a complex of several cryptic species. It has a lot of potential for studying polyploidy since there are so many different karyotypes, so many different chromosome numbers.
Wow. And what is the range? I mean, I'm assuming there's diploids, but at what polyploidy level do you get to with this complex of goblet moss?
Yeah, so again, just looking at the data from the published papers, it seems that the baseline would be 9, and that would be like the N number of chromosomes.
Okay.
And then you have like diploids, triploids, tetraploids, and up to 7N or 8N, that number.
Wow, that's remarkable.
And you know, they are out there in your backyard, and they may have a lot of things to teach about these mechanisms in mosses, so that's interesting.
Yeah, so what kind of questions are you asking before we get into the what people can do to help you? You know, what are you asking? Is this a general sort of, we're just investigating the structure and complexity of this group, or do you have certain questions and testable hypotheses in mind?
The long-term objective is to disentangle the mess, right?
I like that.
Yeah, so what's the story behind that? You know, how many taxonomic units should you recognize? How many times have polyploidy occurred? So that's more or less what we want to do. I want to clarify that this is actually a huge project, right? So it's a collaborative project that it has been funded recently by the National Science Foundation. And we are 3 PIs, 3 principal investigators here, Dr. Bernard Goffinet from UConn, Dr. Matt Johnson from Texas Tech University, and myself. So in order to solve this mess, we are going to break the project into different parts, and we are all going to, you know, apply different approaches to try to find out a little bit what's going on.
Cool.
I mean, we need to reconstruct the phylogeny, obviously, so try just using high-throughput sequencing to see what has been the evolutionary history of the different lineages, etc. But since the ploidy level is the focus of interest, we need to check how many ploidy levels are out there and what's their distribution, how many times they have changed, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think it's really cool about this project is that we are actually going to test reproductive isolation in the lab.
Wow.
So we can actually investigate whether the different strains and the different types of polyploids, whether they can interbreed among them or not.
Huh. And I'm assuming because it's a relatively disturbance-adapted species, you're just going to grow them up in the lab and mix and match? And I mean, how do you go about breeding mosses? That's fascinating.
Yeah, so all this started, I mean, in the years that I was a postdoc at the University of Connecticut, I received there some training about how to grow mosses from this species. And it's pretty cool, actually. The circumstance that allows us to also play with the different polyploids is that unlike many flowering plants, unlike many vascular plants, you can produce polyploids in the lab, which is also why this is a very interesting system. So think about this. You have like a growing sporophyte, a young sporophyte, and you can grow it into a petri dish. The sporophyte typically would be diploid, right? Mm-hmm. 2N. But if you grow the sporophyte under particular circumstances, you can produce a diploid gametophyte that will give birth later to a tetraploid sporophyte, right? So there you go. You produce an autopolyploid in the lab.
Wow.
And then whenever you are ready to perform like these crossings, you can, with a pipette, to actually catch the sperm cells with of one particular culture and inseminate the archegonium, you know, the structure that keeps the egg cell, in another part. So, yeah, huh. I'm excited about that part. Yes.
Yeah, that's so cool. I had no idea that was kind of A, possible, and then just this idea of, you know, these tiny little droplets and pipettes and working around, that's, I just love that you're combining this horticulture, some genetic science, evolutionary science. It's, that's a really neat thing to add to all of this great genetic and phylogenetic work that's going to be going on.
Yeah, it's a lot, right? But I think that one of the things that is exciting about this is to really try to be comprehensive, or at least trying to use like different perspectives to give an answer to this question.
Yeah, and that's really important because, again, a lot of these things can be hypothetical, they can be theoretical, you know, some of the data can support it, but having this collaborative effort, having, like you said, this comprehensive approach really allows the narrative to be, at least allows you to be more sure of the narrative and to tell a more complete story of the big picture.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you like it.
Yeah, that's I really am cheering for your success because this is really cool collaborative science. But of course, you mentioned there's a citizen science component, and my listeners love citizen science. So how is this going to plan out? What do you need from people, and how can they get involved?
Well, you know, this citizen science component is born due to two circumstances. The first one is that we are going to need a lot of samples, right? We need to have like a good representation of all the diversity of these moths in North America and Europe. And we don't have the resources or the time to actually go to all these places and try to find the spores and everything. So we could really have some help. That would be amazing. And then the other circumstance is that whenever I talk with amateur botanists and naturalists, they complain that they don't know very much about mosses, but they would like to. And I think this can be like a good vehicle for that. Are you familiar with this platform, iNaturalist?
Yeah, it's a great platform.
Yes, I'm also a fan. I really like it. And there was what they call the Moss Week a few years ago. You know, a week in which they try to convince people to go out and identify mosses. And it turned out that the goblet moss was the most observed species that week.
Wow, that's cool.
So it's really a moss that people do find in their backyards.
Yeah.
So I think that that combination makes it perfect for this. So it's like you can really help us using like an ordinary moss that is around you. And it may have a key for us to understand a little bit more how plant evolution works.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, at the same time, you're going to have listeners and people that are getting involved learning some of the terminology, knowing what to look for under a microscope, what kind of characters are important, what isn't. And again, like you said, it's a readily available moss. It's something that's in a lot of people's backyards. It's a great little gateway moss drug into the world of bryophyting as a whole. And you might even create some little bryophyte nuts in the process. That's also kind of a nice feather in the cap to this project, is you could get a handful of citizens that are going to walk away totally obsessed with bryophytes now.
Well, hopefully that's what is going to happen. I mean, any help is welcome. We are calling this little project the Fisco Hunt.
I like it.
So Fisco, like the first letters of Fiscometrium, P-H-Y-S-C-O, and then Hunt, because we actually want you to go out there and hunt for mosses. I mean, I hope that you can share this with your audience in your website, but we have some links ready. We have a project on iNaturalist, and we will be there like monitoring and centralizing all the observations that you can provide.
Yeah.
So it will be helping us to understand like what's the phenology of the species and the distribution. Typically, it grows more in the spring, but we know that in the fall there is like another like short growing season. So we hope that this is going to be like the timing is good for now in the fall to let's see if we can find these goblet mosses out there.
Yeah.
So that will be already amazing, right? And we will be there to give you feedback, to help you identifying these species and other moss species through iNaturalist or if you want to contact us directly. But for those of you that wants to go that extra step, we can actually, I mean, we will appreciate if you can send us the samples that you find.
Oh.
Yes, so you will have available a training pack so with all the information about where to find it, how to document your finding, and if you are so generous to actually give us like that extra time, send us a sample and we will give you a reward, and we will try to grow that strain anywhere in North America or Europe and incorporate that into the project.
That is so cool. Oh man, I'm so excited for this project just on that alone. So not only are people going to be able to go out and learn some of this, get their hands dirty, so to speak, in moss identification, they're going to be able to interact with you, and you're going to provide a lot of great materials for anyone that wants to take the next step, and all of it is kind of outlined and available for people through these websites, in which I will put up links to all of this. Okay, first off, I guess, what are the websites, and you know, what is some of the time frame for all of this that people should be out looking around? And you mentioned fall, but
so the best thing for finding this will be just to maybe Google Fisco Hunt. We have two main websites. We have the website of the project, which is at the University of Connecticut. You can find it just writing biology.ucon.edu. And then the other thing that you will find is the iNaturalist project. And if you just go to the website, if you are already a user, otherwise it's really easy. And you just search for this project, you will find it there.
Fantastic. So again, I will be putting up links to all of those on the website and tweeting them out to people so that they can get these without having to do too much Googling of their own. But these packets, again, they're going to have identification purposes, but I would assume that to make a proper collection that you can then use in the lab, there's going to be some protocols to do that the right way, to ship them the right way, right?
Yes, exactly. That's correct. So in the training pack, everything's explained. There is like an optimal moment during the development of the capsules in which we really want the sample to be collected at that point, because we will have like maximum number of spores and they will be ready to go, right? Mm-hmm. If you collect the moss when it's still not ready, when it's not ripe, you may not have the mature spores ready. And if you collect it when it's too late, the spores will be already released.
Okay.
But all this information is in the training pack. So you can, if you have like a population in your backyard, for example, you can wait until the moment is the right one, and then you can dry the specimen and you can send it to us. You also asked before about the time frame. Well, we hope that this will extend during the duration of the project, which is 3 years. As I said, there are like two seasons. We know that sometimes the goblet moss is out there in the fall. But this will be especially important in the spring, from, let's say, depending on where you are, for example, in North America, from February in the southern states to May or June. And yeah, I mean, we are welcoming all the help that you can give us.
That's absolutely fantastic. This has got to be one of the coolest citizen science projects in botany that I've ever heard of. Whose idea was this?
Well, I mean, we tried to send this project a number of times, and it finally worked this time. But, you know, we have been thinking about this for a number of years already, and we are happy that this is finally becoming a reality.
Yeah, that's got to feel really good. So I guess going forward, if people want to find out more about your previous work or keep up to date on just your research in general and find out more about your love and passion for moss and taxonomy, how do you recommend they find you other than the Citizen Science website?
So you can find me on my professional website. That's rafamedina.com. And I'm also on Twitter, Brio Medina, if you want to find me there.
Fantastic. And I will put up links to both of those as well. But Dr. Medina, this is exciting. I wish you all the best, and thank you so much for talking with us. I really hope my listeners get up and get involved. This is a really great chance to learn about and be able to identify some bryophytes and to help within a fantastic science project.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. I appreciate it. Have yourself a great day.
Thank you. Likewise.
Cheers. All right, now that the episode is over, you can get out there and go look for some moss. I myself am going to try to contribute as best as possible, but what better way to learn moss and get a little bit back in return and give to a great science opportunity here? I know you all love citizen science projects, so there you go. Go check it out, indefensiveplants.com/podcast. Navigate to this episode and check out all the links where you can get all of the information you need to contribute to this wonderful work. I thank Dr. Medina for taking time to talk with us. I'm excited to see what this research brings about. It's a great collaborative effort and a great way to get involved in the scientific process. That's about it for this week. We still have stickers for sale in defensiveplants.com/shop. As always, Patreon is up there and running. Again, thank you to everyone who is giving to the Patreon. It really helps make this podcast possible and it makes it better. And if money isn't your thing, at the very least, consider giving this podcast a review wherever you're downloading it from. Reviews help it reach a wider audience. As always, we have a ton of great stuff on the horizon. So many cool things, so many great interviews, so many great people to come in and talk about their love of plants. So stay tuned, and the best way to do that is to hit that subscribe button. Also, we're on Instagram. Go check us out, In Defense of Plants on Instagram. Regular updates, regular stories, regular tours of plant collections, and various botanizing adventures. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios.